Don't worry about the location if that doesn't feel comfortable for you. It's just, if you want to share it, it just helps us get a sense. If you'd rather keep that private, then that's also fine. And in our group, we were just talking about how we were all in, takes us time to formulate questions or connect with the content. So don't feel like you have to have a perfectly formulated question as well. As it's been said, it's about play as much as exploration. So, you know, jump in there with an experience, something that's come up in meditation, a half formulated thought with no end, and yeah, we'll help you there. So over to you guys, just unmute and jump in, or chat box is open. And we have a first question on the chat box. Hi, Paramananda. I would like to ask about fear. Today you talked about how the ego perspective is always insufficient, whilst the heart perspective is always sufficient. How shall we relate to these in regards to fear? Thank you for your question.
So I'm just kind of trying to breathe into that question and see what's kind of there, you know. I wonder sometimes, I've quoted that little Leonard Cohen thing a couple of times, haven't I? Come, my friends, be not afraid. In love we are born, and in love we pass away. And I don't know, my first reaction to that question is the basic fear is the loss of self, isn't it? Loss of ego, loss of life, loss of... And I wonder, when we're in ego consciousness, because the basic function of that is separation, that's not necessarily negative. I don't want people to think that I necessarily think ego consciousness is negative, because I don't. I think it's functional and necessary, but it's limited and it shouldn't be in charge. That wonderful Gilchrist book a few years ago, wasn't it? Master and His Emissary, where he talking in terms of right and left hemisphere brain, but it's the same sort of thing where he was saying the rational part of the brain has become the master, but it should be a servant. And this is the same with ego consciousness. It should be a servant to the what Jung would call a heart, the self. You know, they're using self in a quite particular way, isn't it? Jung here. He's talking about a kind of a self that's integrated in relationship with the unconscious. You know. So what more meaning what I'm talking about using the term heart or soul. He uses the word self. But anyway, the ego consciousness needs to be in relationship with that and in service to it. And when the ego consciousness is in service to the heart, when the ego consciousness gets scared, which it will do, yeah, we will get scared, we will suffer fear. That part of our psyche will suffer fear because that part of our psyche separated itself out. But if it's in relationship to the fuller psyche, I think it can be, I'm going to use the word mothered, it can be cared for. Yeah, it can be soothed, it can be reassured, it can be cradled by the larger self or the larger psyche or a broader perspective. So it's not that we won't ever get fear, but it's that it will become a workable thing that we can reassure and have a turn towards compassionately, tenderly, I think. It's an interesting question for me because I'm going blind, right? It becomes quite a relevant question. I've never been a particularly fearful person, you know. Of course I've had fear, but I wouldn't call myself a fearful person. But nowadays, if I go out on my own at night, I don't know what. Well, let's put it this way, it would be very easy to be scared. And I kind of feel I've got this choice now. I either live a life dominated by fear, or I just open into it, you know. And I suppose I feel very, very lucky because I've done a fair bit of practice and I feel capable of. Yeah, sometimes it's scary. Sometimes I'm frightened, but I also feel capable of kind of relaxing into it and opening into it and trusting the world. This idea of trusting the world is so important to me. Of course, we can only trust the world on its own terms. It's impermanent, unsatisfactory, and insubstantial. You know, we can't, it's not, I don't mean the world is perfect. But we can trust things as they are, and we can trust our life as it is, which is a life towards death. I don't know if that helps at all. So come back to my, I don't know if I'm answering the question at all, really. But I'm not trying to answer the question, and I'm just, you know, these are just the reflections that question provokes. And so, you know, as a, well, I think the Buddha said something very similar. Certainly, the Stoics, and certainly existentialists, you know, they all seem to be saying the only authentic life we can lead is one that comes into relationship with death. And of course, that both means the physical death, the literal death. But it also means the death of a kind of ego sometimes, and the death of our sense of self. But we can't pretend that won't be scary sometimes. One of the symbols of the heart is the green lion. Green lion. It's a powerful symbol of the heart. This is an alchemical symbol of the heart. Of course, another aspect of the line is courage. And we need courage because sometimes life is very frightening, scary. So we need courage, don't we? We need courage. Yeah. We need to learn to encourage ourselves. Maybe Bodhi leader has some words of wisdom to add.
Well, I think the question was kind of specific around what you were saying, but I think around fear. Yeah, it's often very much based around when our egos feel threatened, isn't it, in some kind of way, or when things aren't. I think we don't like the reality. We don't want to face the reality, or things being impermanent and unsatisfactory and insubstantial. We do want to try and fix things and know where we are in relationship to others in the world. And uncertainty, I think, does provoke a lot of fear.
I was going to say, just maybe it's worth adding that, of course, fear is also a useful and necessary thing to have sometimes. There was that film, wasn't there? Fearless. wouldn't last long in the world, I don't think, if you had no fear. You know, sometimes it's necessary and thing to have, just when it's inappropriate or, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. That was from Zoe. I realise it wasn't private. Thank you, Zoe, for your question.
Well, I don't know if Zoe wants to say anything, respond in any way, or...
She says just, that's a great help. Thank you very much. Oh,
okay. Fine. Lovely.
Emoji hands together. we've had a couple more questions come in the chat box. I'll do one more from the chat box and then open it out to the rest of the group if someone wants to speak in. But this one was an anonymous question, open to both Bodhilila Paramananda. Could you say more about the lack of ritual in Sri Ratna in supporting people in their descent?
Do you want to have a go at that, Bodhilila, first? You might not agree with that. I don't know that I said that, didn't I? I mean, that's just my opinion, you know. But my opinions are often deviant.
Well, I think it's interesting because some people really embrace ritual and some people avoid it. And I think we're still at a place of creating rituals and our own ways of doing things. You know, Sangharakshita created some rituals when he first started. I think he really understood that we needed ritual. We needed to bring in that side that is, you know, surrendering to something higher, that's engaging our imaginations and our hearts and isn't rational, and that it's a really important part of practice, or it can be, you know, and in terms of faith. I mean, I think there is something about doing something in a ritual context that becomes quite meaningful, you know, when you make a decision or when you're trying to let go of something or when you're trying to make a commitment. But I think what Paramananda was getting at, my understanding was that, you know, like in certain cultures, you'd have a whole lot of rituals and ways of being around certain key points or certain times of change and transition that would involve kind of ritualized descent, whereas I think it's more implicit within Sri Ratna. I don't know.
No, I'm not sure about that.
Well, what were you thinking? Yes, the other
well,
one.
I do think for a long time, I think it is changing. I think it is changing from certain individuals. I think Buddhafield also can take a lot of credit for some change. Some of the retreat centers, some individuals. I think it is changing, but I think for quite a lot of the history of Sri Ratna, it was quite solar, actually. It wasn't really that, and I think there are certain aspects, shadow aspects, that were ignored. I do think that. So, and you know, maybe this is, as a movement, we're just beginning, I think, perhaps to come into some maturity, because we've now got a cohort of people that have been practicing 20, 30, 40 years. And so there's some maturity there, and we're beginning perhaps to, as Bodhilila says, you know, these ritual perhaps takes quite a long time if it's going to grow organically, which I suspect it has to. We kind of took on kind of slightly westernized some of the Eastern rituals that are around. Of course, there's rituals within the Tibetan tradition that deal with descent, you know, and Yeah, I think we'll get round to it. I think it will happen, but I think we've got a way to go. Yeah, way to go. And I think in the end, it is dependent on individuals recognizing and valuing that and bringing it into the way they teach and the way they use ritual and the way they understand the spiritual path in a more rounded way. And we're not just emphasizing dhyana and ascent and thinking, everything's good in the best of all possible worlds, that sort of thing. But anyway, I think it just takes time. I think it is changing, But I would encourage, I think there's a whole issue here is broader than just the issue of finding ways to ritually hold shadow or ritually hold the scent. I think that's an important issue, but I think there's a broader issue here of the translation. In my mind, we're at the beginning, the beginning of the beginning of a Western translation of Buddhism, of finding a real of a Buddhism as a spiritual practice really beginning to embed within a Western culture. And by Western, I don't necessarily mean European, because India or whatever also now westernized in many ways. And we're just at the beginning of that adventure. We're not at the end of it. We haven't got things sorted out. Historically, it takes hundreds of years for Buddhism to find its way, to really grow into another culture like Japan or China or Mongolia as it moves. Arguably, it can be accelerated now because we live in a kind of accelerated age. But I still think it's going to take some generations. We're still working with a modest, the first generation is still kind of in, well, it's changing actually, maybe not, but it's only just changed. But the first sort of generation was still kind of running the show up until the last 10 years or so. It's changing, changing. Things are changing, but it's going to take a long time. And personally, I would really, I mean, this is my bias, this is my prejudice, but personally, I'd really like to say to people involved in Sri Ratna, please, please don't think we've finished the job. I think we've just started the job of making a meaningful Dharma in the West. We're nowhere near finished the job. Don't think it's done and dusted. Anyway, that's mine. To me, it's a lot broader issue.
Uriela, any other comments?
No.
So, that's an opportunity for everyone, isn't it? The work's not done. So, I have a couple of questions from the chat box, but it would be great to give the opportunity to the floor, as it were, to see if anyone would like to ask something directly.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Paramananda and Buddhiliya, Satchapara. I was struck by something you said, well, I was struck by many things you said this morning, but one thing was about how the world provides everything you need, and then you listed a whole load of fairly pleasant things, and then you mentioned sickness and death. And so since the beginning of this pandemic, well, since my son has been born, I've been finding it really hard to fight against the how can I put it, the the storyline that illness is avoidable and therefore we can give children a whole lot of vaccinations and they won't have all of those illnesses. And you can choose for a few more and then they won't have those illnesses. And now, you know, with COVID-19 coming up, the whole world is gearing towards getting yet another vaccine. And I know this is like a very complex matter because, yeah, anyway, I'm just thinking like, for me, this like feels all very unnatural. And of course, I do not want anyone to become ill or die. Yet on the other hand, I know that for children, for example, actually getting ill helps them to evolve psychologically. And I have this seen with my son in the past couple of years. Anyway, I was just thinking, like, can you please talk more about the necessity of illness or what you what that might mean for you, or
very difficult, isn't it? I don't know what to say. I had my own son vaccinated when he was a kid. You know? To be honest, if I had another child now, I'd do the same thing. His mum, Charlotte, now, I was talking to her the other day, finding out about this. She's very against vaccination now. I don't want to get involved in this vaccination debate in particular, but it's hard. I mean, I don't know if it's it is how it is, isn't it? There's old age, sickness, and death. That's how it is, you know. And of course, if you get sick when you're, you know, any age, you get sick, particularly if you get sick and die when you're young, that seems very unfair. And from our human perspective, of course, it's very, very unfortunate. But on the other hand, there is another hand that a lot of people that it's very hard unless you're actually in that position, but a lot of people that do suffer severe disability or severe illness, not all of them, some of them might end up quite bitter and think, why did it happen to me? But a surprising lot of people end up understanding it as some kind of opening into something. So it is an opening into, and I do agree with you. I do share this idea that we can make the world safer and safer. You know, what do we lose by making the world safer and safer? What do we lose from kids no longer being allowed to climb a tree or something? You know? Because it's not safe. And of course, if you happen to be the parent of a kid that falls out of the tree and dies, that's tragic and terrible, and do parents ever really recover? Probably not. But does that mean we shouldn't let children? I don't know. I mean, I just don't know. I don't know. It's a real dilemma. And of course, being a parent's a real dilemma. You know, I often say to people, I mean, I didn't plan to have a family, but I would say having a son is probably the best thing that ever happened to me. But I would also say the only thing that really brought in an existential dread into my life. Because I never worried about my own death, particularly. I thought, well, when I die, you know, whatever. I'm not saying I'll be like that when I really face it, but that's always been my attitude. Well, you know, whatever, you know, if I die, I die. But when it's your child, it's not that I spend my time worrying about it, but anybody here who's a parent would know exactly what I mean. But is that existential dread a bad thing, or does it in some way soften and open you? I think it does. It's such a complicated area. Isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know what to make. But we can explore it. And it'd be nice. I mean, of course, these are sort of issues that a live sangha should be exploring, you know, because these are the issues that make us human, aren't they? There's no solution to them. There's no pat answer. There's no correct answer. But the exploration is the thing, isn't it?
And I suppose I don't know that I completely agree that the earth provides everything, and because I think there are a lot of people in lots of places where there is a struggle for enough food and a lot of really key resources, and people, you know, die in famines, and people, you know, a lot of people die and get illnesses and things that are quite treatable. I mean, I think there's another issue around being risk averse and not allowing children to have certain experiences and things. I mean,
you kind of misunderstand what I meant when I said that. By saying that.
Well, I know, but I think in a way it. I mean, I find
it's not. It's not what I meant, though, by Lila.
Yeah.
Of course, there's family, but is that the earth? Is that the earth's fault, or is that human culture's fault? It's usually human beings that create famine, not the world. I mean, I'm talking figuratively, aren't I? Obviously, not literally. So, yes, of course there's poverty, and of course there's inequality. But to say that's the fault of the earth is to rather miss what I was trying to convey.
No, I think I understood what you were trying to convey.
For
me, we can't always just look at things figuratively, because there is the sort of literal reality of people's lives in certain...
Well, of course there is, yeah.
And maybe it can deny people's experience if we just assume that. Anyway, that was just something I was thinking.
I think that is very true, Bodhilila, and I think this is my difficulty through, like, for example, in this current crisis, like, one part of me would, like, of course, wants everyone to be well, and yet another part of me kind of holds on to, I suppose, the wisdom of the Buddha, who says, actually, illness and death is unavoidable. And if we look at it in a whole bigger perspective, it's like, you know, a bit like what you said, Paramananda, yesterday about the day before, about the human race looked at from all other species as a cancer. Mm. And it's like something, and I find this really hard to just even say, like, just even here, because I really do not mean people to die. But there seems to be something of a side of a story that doesn't get enough, that isn't voiced or something. Anyway. And I don't have any answers. And, you know, again, it's very complex. I suppose I'm bringing it here because it's been causing me a lot of pain over the past few months. And grief, but thank you both for listening.
Yeah, well, thank you for the question.
Difficult territory. So it's 29 minutes past 5. I will just say there are two questions in the chat box. I might just read them out because I think they're linked, and there's a hunger for people to know a little bit more about this cosmic element in relation to cosmic love for oneself. Mm. And also there was saying more about birth and death are coming into being from the cosmos, from stardust, and now going out. You spoke of energy, and please elaborate. So not for now, probably, to open up that cosmic doorway. But just to drop that in, that there's perhaps that will feed into tomorrow's input. Well, there's curiosity there, cosmic curiosity.
Yeah,
just to honour those questions, thank you for asking them to those who asked. So I think I'm handing it over to someone else in the team to say the last goodbyes. Praninita, is that you? Or?
So I'm going to unmute everybody and feel free to say goodbyes before we meet tomorrow. Have a really good evening, and remember it's day 3, so just be gentle with yourself, and see you all tomorrow.
Hey, thank you all.
Thank you all. Stay well, everybody. Thank you.